for the good of all. And just as I was almost out of grabbing range, Amy snagged the back of my shirt with a fist and turned me around. She said,
thank you for helping me move.
You said that already, no problem. She looked like she had something else to say, quite a bit else, in fact. John said,
yeah, it's not a big deal for me to lift heavy objects. I'm sort of used to it. If you know what I mean.
I held up a hand to silence him. John,
of course I'm talking about my penis.
I said to Amy, ignore him. His penis is just like everybody else's. Amy said, I was just going to ask you if...
You've never seen my penis, bellowed John. I'd show it right now to everybody here if we had time.
I turned on him. If we had time? What?
Because, well, if you want to look at my penis, then you'd better have a whole afternoon, buddy. You best have 5 or 6 hours to take it all in, lest its majesty escape you.
Before I could stop her, Amy said, that doesn't make any sense.
It would make sense if you could see it, shouted John, plainly agitated. It would be making long sense, honey.
John, just calm down, okay? I gestured down the hall. Go wait by the elevator. He didn't move. From behind me, I heard Amy say, do you want to get engaged? And there it was. I had a sinking feeling, visualized a moth flapping toward a blowtorch. I tried to think of the best, most soothing way to turn her down and said, sure. John looked at his watch.
Well, congratulations. Now we gotta roll. If we leave now, there'll still be enough light to get in some basketball.
The day was so hot, it stank. Asphalt baked under our shoes. Bodies rustled against one another, dancing to the irregular pap-pap-pap beat of a basketball smacking the pavement. I backed toward the hoop, about where the free-throw line would be if we had played on an actual court, rather than this giant cracked piece of playground sandpaper. I spun, jumped, threw up a shot that was doomed the moment it left my fingers. John snatched the rebound, spun, jumped, slammed. He pumped his fist in victory.
Ring it up! 274 to 137.
In John's game, each shot is worth 137 points.
If I had a dime for every basket I made today, you'd still suck.
I tracked down the loose ball and handed it to John. In this game, like life, scoring means you get to keep the ball. He dribbled twice, glanced up over my shoulder, and froze. I saw the expression on his face and turned. John squinted and asked,
was that there before?
It was a black sphere, floating just above the weeds at courtside. It was gleaming at about 3 feet wide, looking like a giant hovering eight ball. John strode over to it, and I heard him say,
you can sort of see into it. I think I see people.
He bent over and picked up a broken chunk of concrete. He lobbed it at the sphere, which swallowed it noiselessly. John looked over his shoulder at me and said,
hole to another dimension, I bet. Want to go through?
After this point, John got the ball and dribbled behind the cracks and bundles of weeds we called the three-point line. I knew from the look in his eyes that he was going to take the shot. As soon as the ball left his hands, I was bounding toward the rim, that subconscious gauge in the back of my mind already telling me it was a miss off the backboard. It clanged. I leapt. I scooped the rebound from the air one-handed, and before John could recover into defense, I turned and hooked a shot that ripped prettily through the net.
Like a drop in the bucket, baby, I said. Splash.
Damn, John said, hands on his hips, chest heaving.
Your game be chubby today.
He said this in such a way so that chubby rhymed with today.
Tied at 274, Monster Dave.
He retrieved the ball from the grass, then heaved a chest pass at me that missed badly. I turned to watch the ball go, and sure enough, saw it hit the black sphere and disappear just like the piece of concrete had.
Whoops, said John. I tossed our ball into another universe.
You want to go home?
Yeah, just let me get my ball.
He walked over to the sphere and peered into it. He lifted a leg and stuck it through, then ducked in, and soon it was just his left leg sticking out of this floating ball. He pulled it through, and he was gone. I sighed, looked at my watch, and wandered toward the spherical portal. I knew he wasn't coming back until I at least poked my head through, so I bent over and pushed my way in. The air on the other side was at least 30 degrees cooler. I stepped out, realizing as I did that I was emerging from a white sphere on this side, brilliant as sunlit snow. I stepped out onto a basketball court that itself was not terribly different than the one we had left. But the world was changed nonetheless. The sun was gone. The overcast sky was an unnatural ceiling of tar-flavored cotton candy, and the air had a vague farty smell. I scanned the landscape and saw other small differences. The park, in undisclosed, had been in a polished neighborhood, Victorian homes and carpet lawns. Here, the houses looked empty and forgotten, windows smashed, weeds overgrowing, rusting mailboxes. The yellowing white house nearest to us had a single nonsense word spray-painted across the front. Bloodworms. A dry wind blew, bringing with it that vague sulfur stench once again. I saw John standing nearby, looking up at the rim of one of those half-dozen goals that bordered the court. He said, "Where have you been? I've been walking around for 2 hours. Time must move differently here. I came right after you." "That's always your excuse," I said. "At least it's cooler here." "No nets here, though." He was right. The naked rim stood silently over us like very tall, thin, and largely ineffective sentries. He said, "This one's regulation, but a couple of those other goals are bent on the rims. Must be a lot of dunking in this world." There was a tinkling sound from behind us, glass breaking. We both turned. A bone-thin woman dressed in rags stumbled toward us. She had feebly hurled a glass jar at us that crashed 20 feet short on the pavement. Her eyes were swollen in amazement, a bony finger aimed right at us.
"You," she screeched. "Unstained! Unstained! How?"
Her left arm was missing, ending just above her elbow in a jagged stump, as if it had simply rotted off. Her screaming was suddenly cut short when four beings I can only describe as some kind of flying baboons descended on her, beating her savagely with clubs. They hauled her unconscious body into the sky. We watched them fly away, saw they weren't coming back for us. We exchanged a look, then shot free throws to see who would start with the ball. John won. We played for a bit, but the game wasn't that much fun. It was the wind. That steady, rotten wind that blew constantly from the south and brought with it faint sounds of screaming and an insectal shrieking noise. It drove every outside shot off the mark by a couple of inches. Soon we both abandoned three-point shots, which brought the game under the hoop. That was John's domain. His 3-inch height advantage gave him a series of rebounds and easy layups, quickly giving him a 548-point lead. Sweat stung my eyes as I drove under the hoop once more, trying a little running hook under the baseline. John's hands were quick, swatting the shot away. The ball went bouncing off the court. "Hey," John shouted after it. "Toss it back." I turned to see who he was shouting at. There, by the ball, was hovering what looked vaguely like one of those wet-dry shop bags they sell at Sears. It made no sound. I could only presume it was some kind of droid common to this world, though it lacked any kind of eyes or robotic facial features we add to our movie robots to give them personality. What it did have was a bristling array of probes in front of it that were aimed at the two of us, sensors of some kind. I said, "That thing doesn't have any kind of ball-handling appendages. You're going to have to go after it." John turned on me, indignant. "I got it last time." After 5 solid minutes of debate, we decided to go get it together. At the ball site, we noticed the droid was still there, taking its silent measurements or whatever. To our surprise, it spoke.
"Identification, please."
John smiled.
"Assy Cocklord."
It turned to me, repeated the question.
"Philippe Normawang?"
"Identification not on database. Please state your habitation sector."
John said.
"Your ass."
Me. "The suburbs west of your ass?"
"Sector not on database. Please report to your nearest quarantine facility. Failure to report within 30 minutes will result in..."
We walked away and left the thing chattering back there. It was my ball, and I managed to score 2 quick baskets to get myself back into the game. Suddenly, from the sky rose a wobbly, mechanical thumping sound, like a car running on a flat tire. I looked up at it, and John took the opportunity to steal the ball from my sweat-coated hands. He stepped and hopped and again utilized his genetic ability to dunk a basketball.
"Booyah!" he said, arms in the air. "Dunk off of a steal. I done dominated you in 2 universes, bitch."
I was sick of basketball. My game had gone as sour as the ominous wind that blew, and I longed for the courts of my own universe. Also, that distracting pulsing sound grew louder. I grabbed the ball and sat down on it, using it as a stool. John said, "Come on, let's get in another game before we have to go back to Hot World. I bet it's not even 70 out here." "Nah," I said. I noticed an old-time brown newspaper on the ground, headline in 3-inch-tall letters. "Phenomenon continues around South Pole. President urges calm." That thrumming, pulsing sound got louder. Suddenly, there was a sharp crack, and we both spun around. Where the shop-back droid had been, there was now only a charred spot on the ground and bits of twisted debris. Above and behind it were 5 human figures flying slowly toward us on little booths that looked like lecterns. They descended, landing in front of us, undulating clouds of bright blue plasma cushioning the machines as they touched down. All 5 were adult males, clean, wearing sleek black uniforms that looked military. It occurred to me that they had probably been nearby for some time now, but had been hidden by some kind of futury cloaking device like those ships on Star Trek. They stepped off their flying machines and approached us. One guy took the lead, a handsome officer in his 30s, a neatly trimmed beard. "Good afternoon," he said. "I am Sergeant Vance McElroy of the Human Liberation Army. Your appearance here must be quite a surprise to you, but not to us. Prophecy has foretold the coming of strangers from another world since the day of the Great Corruption. It is an honor to meet you. I confess that I do not know from where you came, but I can tell by looking at you that you have not been infected with the—" He talked for what seemed like forever. The wind kicked up again, and I wondered if there were any indoor courts here. I couldn't find a pause long enough to ask the guy. I looked over and saw John giving the man a series of his fake, "I'm listening" thoughtfully nods. "And if you cannot defeat him, then all hope for mankind is lost. Gentlemen, the winds of destiny have blown us together. A bright dawn is about to grace this lost and broken world." We hung in awkward silence for a moment, but then I had an idea. "Question," I said. "That flying shop back earlier mentioned a quarantine. I presume they used old public buildings for this, such as hospitals and schools, right? So my question is, do any of these converted quarantines still have their gymnasiums intact? Or at least the part that had the basketball goals?" "No, I'm afraid all of the educational institutions were razed with the first siege, right before the mass book burnings. Human ignorance has been their greatest weapon. But that is not the worst the Dark Ones have done. Often the—" He droned on, and I instantly regretted asking the question. I looked at my watch, saw that it displayed 6669 as the time. I began to accumulate a list of all the ways this universe sucked. "Therefore, only with your unique otherworldly genetic makeup can you resist the infection of the—" "Yes, that's very interesting," said John. "But to perform this task you request, we'll need a number of items from our world. You must allow us to return there and come back to begin our quest." The man nodded. "It is good, then. We shall await your return." We picked up our ball and ducked back through the dimensional rift. We stepped from the black sphere and were glad to see the sunlight and netted goals. We weren't so happy with the return of the oppressive heat, but decided to deal with it rather than return to that other crappy, dysfunctional universe. We decided on one more game. Before we could inbound the ball, a gang of 4 strong-looking, attractive 20-somethings walked up. 2 boys, 1 black, 1 white. 2 girls, 1 Asian, 1 a pretty blonde. They oozed curiosity upon seeing the portal and exchanged what sounded from a distance like witty comments. The white boy and girl seemed to dislike each other, and bickered good-naturedly as they stepped through the portal, a sense of adventure in the air. John rolled his eyes. We had an argument over who had the ball last, but John finally admitted he was wrong, and gave it to me. We played for a bit, but fatigue had set in and we exchanged 2 missed shots each. Then, suddenly, all 4 of the 20-somethings were ejected from the black sphere. They were covered in dirt and bruises and minor cuts.
"Look," gushed the Asian girl. "It's the same moment when we left. None of that time passed here."
"She's right," said the black kid.
"Yo, am I glad to see that, son. We saved the whole damn world, man."
The white boy and girl kissed, apparently having fallen in love during their quest. The boy disengaged and looked at us with excited eyes.
"Dude, you guys won't believe what just happened to us."
John turned to him.
"You bored a stranger with your stupid-ass story, and he pulled out his cock and whipped you with it like a stagecoach driver?"
The kid shut up, baffled.
John picked up the ball and bounced a pass to me. Your ball.
Science and the Beyond, Dr. Albert Marconi, page 375, was the last survivor of the plague. As the team made its way through the abandoned village, the priest described the outbreak that had taken every single member of the tribe but him. Painful sores, blindness, madness, limbs that in the course of minutes seemed to rot and split like bad fruit. Horrors an old man should not have to see in his declining years. The priest had lived to the ripe old age of 37. The priest believed he had been spared by Kodak only to relay the tale to me, to warn me off. He bid me farewell, saying he intended to strike out into the jungle, to walk west until he touched the sun or until the land reclaimed him. I didn't tell him that walking that direction meant he might wind up as part of a tour group out of Iquitos. I shook his hand and left Peru for good. A week later, I was back in New York, relaxing with Sharon after Dr. Haline's memorial service, enjoying cups of coffee laced with a great deal of brandy. We stood on the balcony, looking over the city through clouds of my pipe smoke. Sharon said, "Those poor people, why did they have to die?" I snorted a laugh around my pipe. "We all have to, dear." She didn't smile. "You know what I mean, the way they died, sick and blind and screaming for their gods to save them, with no answer in return." She turned her eyes to me. "The gods are cruel, aren't they, Albie?" I drew a deep breath and replied, "Every living being has but one need, power. Power over other living things. You need it to grow, to eat, to reproduce. And cruelty is the ultimate expression of power, to impose needless, extreme suffering and humiliation on another. It is the purest demonstration of strength. Toddlers learn it in the nursery. Therefore, every organism, from the microbe up, wears its cruelty as a badge to mark its upward progress. Prey must be subdued. Competition must be starved. Enemies must be wiped out. One would thus assume that we find the same among the gods, only more so. That at each level of the heavens we find higher and higher levels of greed, brutality, and mindless spite. How else could they have become gods?" Sharon shivered, though it was not cold on the balcony. In a barely audible voice she asked, "But is that really the way it is? The work you do? You would know better than anyone." I set my pipe aside and turned to let her look into my eyes. I said, "This has been a presentation of Audio Go. For more information on related titles from Audio Go, please visit us online at audiogo.com. John dies at the end. Text copyright 2009 by David Wong. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011 by Audio Go. All rights reserved."
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.